If you're a pro, you know that this is not efficient because you know there's a better way. There's also a better way to save. When pro customers buy building supplies in bulk at Lowe's, they save up to 20% every day. Buy in bulk and save up to 20% on concrete, gypsum, and gypsum accessories. At Lowe's, buy more, save more. Visit the Pro Desk or lowesforpros.com for details. Discount applies to contractor pack items. Minimum purchase required, U.S. only.
You are Locked On Clippers, your daily Los Angeles Clippers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Locked On Clippers podcast. I'm your host. Today is Monday, October 23rd, 2017, and we are here today to talk about the Clippers' first two victories of the NBA season against the Los Angeles Lakers and Phoenix Suns, and then break down the Milos Teodosic injury, what his prognosis is, and what the Clippers' rotation looks like moving forward without him. I do want to quickly apologize that we did not have episodes on Thursday and Friday of last week. I had some really weird issues with my recording software, and I ended up recording the episode and then losing it and recording it and losing it, and I was able to download some updates over the weekend and get back on my feet. So what we're going to do today, since we're a little behind, is we'll talk about those first two games and the Teodosic injury, because those are kind of the most pressing things. And then there's some Agua Caliente Clippers news that we'll kind of push to later in the week when we have a little more time. And we won't really talk about the Clippers' upcoming game against the Utah Jazz until tomorrow. That game is tomorrow night. So, getting into it, the Clippers played their first two games of the season, Thursday and Saturday, against the Lakers and the Phoenix Suns. They beat the Lakers Thursday night by a score of 108-92. They beat the Suns by a score of 130-88. So two pretty solid wins. The Clippers did have a 30-point lead against the Lakers before some garbage time closed the gap. And they actually weren't up by as much against the Suns until garbage time blew it open. But two really solid blowout wins against two teams that you should have solid blowout wins against. So not necessarily anything to overly celebrate, but definitely something that, you know, that we can and should be happy with, that they came in, they looked relatively good, they played relatively well together considering the massive roster turnover, and they were able to get two easy wins. Now we'll see more significant tests coming up against Utah and Portland this week, which are two teams, again, that the Clippers should beat, but a little more competitive. These are teams that will be competing for those lower Western Conference playoff seeds, and the Clippers are going to want to, over the course of this season, really set themselves apart from that, you know, New Orleans, Utah, Portland tier of teams. And so the first step to doing that, obviously, would be getting head-to-head victories against them in the first week of the season. So a little bit more of a test. We'll see a little bit more how the Clippers stack up against, you know, NBA-caliber rosters this week. But still, two good wins. And so I don't want to get ahead of myself, so I'll talk a little bit about those two wins. First, I want to talk about the Milos Teodosic injury. So Teodosic has an injured plantar fascia in his left foot. So the plantar fascia, which I'm probably mispronouncing, is the ligament that connects your heel to your toes. So as you can imagine, it would be kind of hard to walk without that. So we don't know exactly what the extent of the injury is. It could be small tears, it could be a strain, it could be a full tear. This is different than plantar fasciitis, which is a chronic condition involving small tears in the plantar fascia that do not heal. So you just, it's kind of, plantar fasciitis is a chronic condition that you are continually re-aggravating and missing 3 to 7 days with, and you know, you're out a week, you're out 2 weeks, but then you're back, and then you aggravate it again, etc. So this torn plantar fascia has a much more significant impact than just aggravating plantar fasciitis, but could easily turn into long-term plantar fasciitis depending on how it heals. So what we could see potentially is Milos come back from this injury, whenever he does come back, and within, you know, at some point this season or next season going forward in the future, he could aggravate that plantar fasciitis again and then have to miss, you know, a week or so, depending on how that recovery goes. So that's just something to watch. The plantar fascia injury can be really tricky. And you know, as with any injury, it's an individual kind of thing. So it just depends on the person and it depends on where the ligament is torn and, you know, how badly it's torn and all that. He said he heard a pop, which suggests a full tear. But I'm not, hashtag not a doctor. So I don't know. But I did a little bit of checking into this. It looked like Pau Gasol did a similar thing in 2013. He tore his plantar fascia, and his timeline that the Lakers medical staff gave him was 6 to 8 weeks, and he was back on the early end of that timeline. Now, I spoke with a doctor yesterday who told me that for a fully torn plantar fascia, it could be closer to 3 to 4 months. But because the Clippers are being a little ambiguous and they're only saying plantar fascia injury instead of torn plantar fascia, we don't really know the extent. And so the person that I spoke to, the doctor that I spoke to, was hopeful that the Clippers would be able to get him back in the 10 to 12 week range, you know, ideally somewhere in the first couple weeks of January. So if we operate on that timeline, and again, that could change drastically in either direction, because as we saw Pau Gasol come back from it in about 6 weeks, which would put Milos closer towards the first week of December than the first couple weeks of January. Or with foot injuries like this, it's possible that if he aggravates it during his rehab process, it could push him later into the season. But hopefully we'll have him back by January, at which point he'll be able to get back into rhythm and everything and get plenty of games under his belt going into the postseason. But in the meantime, the Clippers are going to have some really, really interesting decisions to make regarding their rotation, because Doc Rivers was already rolling with a 9-man rotation, and he wasn't playing a ton of 3-guard lineups. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But first, if you want to see the Clippers live this season with all their new guys, buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just 2 taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code LONBA today. That's promo code LONBA for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. So talking about who's going to replace Milos in the rotation or who stands to benefit from it, I think it's probably better if I organize the rest of this episode where I talk about that last. So I'm going to talk about what I saw in the first two games, what Doc Rivers is doing with his rotation, who's playing well, who's doing what well, etc. And then at the end, once I've kind of laid all of that out on the table, kind of tell you guys what I think is going to happen going forward without Milos. I think that makes a little more sense. So I'm going to start with the Lakers game from last Thursday, the Clippers' first game. So I think the thing that struck out to me most about this game, and really game two as well, was with Blake Griffin, how quietly dominant he was. I don't think in either game Blake Griffin really went off. He never took over. He never, you know, exploded or anything like that. He was just quietly efficient. You know, game one against the Lakers, 29 points, 12 rebounds, 3 assists on 12 of 23 shooting, 3 of 6 from deep. And then game two against the Suns, he had, again, 29 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists, 7 of 13 from the field, 3 of 5 from deep, 12 of 14 from the free throw line. So we're seeing him in that pick and pop, step behind the three-point line, and hit those open shots comfortably. And then we're seeing him rebound the ball relatively well. I mean, 12 rebounds is something that, you know, we don't see often from Blake Griffin in the regular season these days. And we're seeing him score efficiently, over 50% from the field. And then I think it was really cool to see him in that Phoenix game. They didn't let him shoot as much as the Lakers did, you know, 10 less attempts, but he had 12 more free throw attempts, and he hit 12 of the 14. So it's really kind of impressive to see him hitting those shots. But so Blake, I think, has been really good. I'm really interested to see if this is his baseline. Like, he's not really doing much right now to get these, you know, this 29 point, 10 rebound, 4 assist average, right? This is like, I don't feel like he's had a great game yet. Now, he is shooting well above where he will end up shooting from three. That number is going to come down. Obviously, he's over 50% right now. I think he'll be in the mid-30s when all is said and done, which is still good. But so maybe the 29 points won't be 29 points. Maybe the 29 points will be 26 points, 25 points. But if it's 26 points, 10 rebounds, and 4 assists without really going off, I'm really interested to see what it looks like when he takes over, when he has a dominant stretch of 5 games. You know, can he average, if he's going to average 25 points a game, can he have a stretch where he scores 40 every night for a week? Maybe. And keep in mind, in these two games also, his minutes were low. I mean, he did play 34 minutes against the Lakers because Doc kind of played him and Gallinari, or Doc brought the starters back into the game at the end for some reason. But he wasn't really looking to score at that point. He was more, you know, deferring to the other guys. And then against the Suns, only playing 28 minutes. So in these more competitive games that are coming up, will we see Blake Griffin take over? And when that happens, will we see the Blake Griffin that we've seen at times in the past, where he kind of gets a little tight and struggles underneath increased pressure? Or will we see Blake kind of carry over the momentum from these first couple of games and instead dominate even more once he starts to really apply himself to a greater degree? But I've been really impressed with what I've seen from Blake so far. Danilo Gallinari has been less than great, but not necessarily like horrible, just not hitting shots, which is kind of what you look for him to do as a shooter. He's a good, well-rounded player, but shooting is the one thing he does. And so 3 of 13 from the field in the first game, 4 of 14 from the field in the second game, and a combined 5 of 14 from three-point is not Gallinari's game. He's much, much better and more efficient than that. And we'll see that as the season goes on. I haven't seen anything to make me especially worried. What's really interesting to me about Gallinari is how slow he is. When he runs up the court, he's just a very slow guy. But it doesn't really serve as a detriment to his game. Now, he's not beating very many guys off the dribble. He did beat Alex Len off the dribble against the Suns, but Alex Len is Phoenix's backup center, so I'm not sure that really demonstrates an impressive first step for Gallinari. But he's comfortable dribbling the ball up the court. He's a comfortable passer, even though he's not like an amazing creator. He has 4 assists through 2 games, but he makes the right pass. He makes a smart play. And I think he's been capable on defense. I haven't seen anything stick out, you know, bad on defense, which is something I was a little worried about. Now, it has been, again, against the Lakers and the Suns, so I think we'll definitely see a little more to worry about when the Clippers play against teams with really dominant scoring wings, and he's put in a position to guard, you know, whether it be Paul George or LeBron James or Kevin Durant. It'll be really interesting to see how the Clippers handle those matchups. But Gallinari, I think, has been fine. He just needs to hit those shots, which I think he will. So everything's been good except the ball hasn't been going in yet, which I think the ball will go in. I think another thing that's interesting is that Doc Rivers has kept Griffin or Gallinari on the floor pretty much at all times in these first two games until we reached garbage time in the late second half. And he's pretty much only employed Wesley Johnson as a backup forward option. So he'll bring in Wesley for Gallinari and then let Wesley play small forward and Blake play power forward to close out the first quarter. And then in the second quarter, bring Gallinari back in for Blake. And now Gallinari is playing power forward, and then bring Blake back in for Wesley. So he's been really just rotating those three guys, which is not horrible, but I'm just not sure that it's sustainable over the course of an 82-game season. I think you do look to kind of work either Montrezl Harrell at power forward or Sam Dekker at small forward or power forward into the lineup a little bit more going forward, just because I don't know that you could play 82 games relying on three guys rotating between the forward spot. Now, I think you can get away with three guys, you know, three guards or three forwards or three bigs or whatever. Maybe you can split two positions between three guys on a night-to-night basis or in a playoff series when you shorten your rotation. But, I mean, if you think about it, two positions is 96 minutes. And this is going to be relevant, actually, when we talk about what the Clippers do without Milos Teodosic, too. It's the same thing with point guard and shooting guard as it is with small forward and power forward. Two positions is 96 minutes. If you split that between three guys, that's 32 minutes a guy. 32 minutes is not a crazy amount. And if you look at the guard situation, 32 minutes is not crazy for Beverly. It's not crazy for Austin Rivers. It's a little high for both Austin and Lou Williams, but it's not insane. Now you look over at the forwards, 32 minutes is good for Blake and it's good for Gallo, but not for Wesley Johnson. And so what you end up seeing is extra minutes to Blake, extra minutes to Gallo. And I just think it's a lot of strain to put on two guys who have had chronic injury issues in their career. The other side to that is because these are two guys who often get hurt, you'd probably like to have Sam Dekker or Montrezl Harrell, you know, in form, in shape, playing with the team night in and night out, even if it's only 12 minutes, because odds are Blake Griffin and Gallinari are each going to miss some games at some point this season. And so do you want a guy who hasn't played all year coming in to play 25 minutes a night when they're out, or do you want a guy who's been playing 8 or 10 minutes and getting used to the system and all that? So I do think Doc Rivers, I think he should, and I think he will look to integrate Montrez and Dekker as the season goes on. I think that a part of it might just be their newness to the team. There was one play against the Suns where Doc Rivers literally came out on the court to push Sam Dekker over to where he was supposed to be in the offensive set. So maybe these guys just need a little more time to adjust to this Clippers system in a new team, again, with a ton of roster turnover and like a totally brand new everything. It makes sense that some guys would come along a little slowly. I also think that just because of the nature of the Clippers backup front court, each of these guys is, you know, has holes in their game, but they can all also contribute. So I think Sam Dekker might be used in certain lineups. I think Montrezl Harrell might be used in certain lineups. I was talking about this with someone over the weekend, that Willie Reed is like DeAndre Jordan light, right? And so he's your traditional center. He comes in, he protects the rim, he rebounds, he guards big guys, great. But there are some games when you don't need that. When maybe less than you need a DeAndre Jordan, you need like a you know, a Montrezl Harrell kind of guy. Now DeAndre Jordan is obviously going to start and play every game because he's amazingly good, but there might be matchups when the energy and, you know, the way Montrez runs the floor and finishes on the pick and roll and on the break, if you don't need the rim protection that Willie provides, maybe you look to Montrez on those nights. And Doc has also said that he wants to play lineups with Blake Griffin at center, which we haven't seen yet. And so that's something that we could also see. So there is a lot of flexibility down there. But again, if you move Blake Griffin to center, now you need someone to take even more of those forward minutes, right? It's not going to be Willie Reed. So you look again to Dekker and Montrezl Harrell, likely to be worked in the lineup. Wesley Johnson, however, seems to be in a, you know, fairly solid footing as the number three forward in the Clippers rotation, which is not something that I foresaw considering how bad he was last season. But he came in the preseason, he earned that spot in camp, he was confident in the preseason, he's in that spot now, still going into the season, and he's playing well. I don't think he's entrenched. Of the nine-man rotation, I'd say that maybe he has the most vulnerable spot just because of the guys behind him that are competing for those minutes. And because we've seen Doc Rivers kind of be quick to pull him out of the rotation in years past when he isn't playing well. But I do think right now, as long as he's playing well, I have no problem in that spot. And he's hitting shots. He's playing good defense. Against the Lakers, he had a good scoring game. 9 points, 5 rebounds, 1 assist, 1 steal. And then against the Suns, only 3 points, but he had 3 rebounds, 3 assists, 3 rebounds, 2 assists, 2 steals. So solid all around. You know, we know what Wesley does. He's a good team defender. He's been pretty good on the ball so far, but it doesn't quite stay in front of quicker guys. But yeah, so I've been pleased with that so far, and I think that's been a surprise to me, definitely. If you listen to the show, you know I wasn't expecting Wesley to be a big contributor, especially not ahead of Sam Decker and Montrezl Harrell in the rotation. DeAndre has been great. You know, I don't think there's a whole ton to say about DeAndre. That first game against the Lakers, 14 points, 24 rebounds. Second game against the Suns, a little less prolific, 6 points, 13 rebounds, but still very good in both games, doing exactly what you need him to do. And then Willie Reed coming in off the bench, I thought actually had a pretty poor game against the Lakers. You know, the stats are fine, 8 points, 5 rebounds, but he looked a little lost on several occasions. I wasn't super thrilled, but I wasn't, you know, it's just one game, and we know that Willie Reed is a very good player, so I wasn't worried, but I didn't think that he played well against the Lakers. I thought he really came back and had a really strong performance against the Suns. Now, part of that might be because the Suns looked like they didn't really give a crap about the game even when they were still in it, and they definitely didn't give a crap about the game later on when it was garbage time and Willie Reed was in, but he took either two or three charges in that game. He was rolling aggressively to the basket and finishing lobs from a variety of different guards. He had 12 points on 6 of 6 shooting. So, you know, that's what I'm hopeful to see. And I think it's really encouraging to see against the Suns, even though, again, the Suns are so bad and they're playing so lackadaisically that the entire floor opens up in a way that it normally is not against a good NBA defense. I do think it's encouraging to just see so many different guard, big, lob combinations, because it just kind of shows that there's an overall well-rounded chemistry here where we've got Austin Rivers finding, you know, we know that Austin can find DeAndre, but we've got Austin finding DeAndre and then Austin finding Willie. We've got Lou Williams finding Willie Reed, but then also finding Montrezl Harrell. And we've got Patrick Beverley finding everybody. So that's just a really good, you know, I think to see everyone kind of distributing to everyone. Instead of, I feel like in years past, there's been like certain combinations. Like we know that Jamal and DJ work well together, et cetera. That's not been the case this year. So now, just talking about the guards, or I guess I'll talk a little bit more about each of the backup forwards. So Decker, I talked about, he looks a little lost, but I am excited to see him play once he earns the playing time. Montrez, I think might have a better chance of competing to poach some minutes from Willie Reed at center, depending on the matchup, as an energy guy, because the forward competition is pretty stiff right now. But again, Doc is only playing three forwards right now. So that fourth forward spot, those minutes are available if someone can step up and earn them. I'm just not sure that Montrez is a good pairing with Willie Reed or with DeAndre Jordan, which kind of limits what you can do with him at the power forward spot, unless you're going to play him with Blake Griffin, which, you know, is doable. But then again, it's kind of just a semantics issue if Blake is the center and Montrez is the power forward, or Montrez is the power forward and Blake is the center. And the last guy is Bryce Johnson. Bryce had, you know, a decent little showing late against the Suns, which I know probably excited some people. He had a couple little turnarounds in the paint. He had 6 points and 4 rebounds in 6 minutes. But I think the problem with him is the same problem we've seen. He also had three fouls in 6 minutes. He's not strong enough to compete defensively. He's not strong enough to compete on the glass, and he doesn't have the high motor that he needs to use his athleticism in a productive way. You know, and he could use his athleticism in a productive way, especially on defense. You know, being a help guy, being all over the court, blocking shots. He doesn't have the motor to really do that. So, it certainly seems to me that he's number 13 in the Clippers 13-man rotation. I suppose there's something to be said for the fact that he was active and Juwan Evans was inactive, so maybe Doc, you know, likes Bryce a little more than he likes Juwan. But he's been the last guy to come in. He didn't play in the blowout against the Lakers. All the other guys on the roster played in that game, and he played the least in the blowout win against the Suns. So I'm just not sure that he's capable of competing at the NBA level until he gets stronger, and, you know, tries a little bit harder, I think, is another important thing. Now, as far as the guards go, Patrick Beverley, the first game, did kind of what you'd expect Patrick Beverley to do. He bothered Lonzo Ball. He trash-talked him a little bit. He pushed him down one time. You know, that's what you get with Patrick Beverley. You know, the good and the bad of it. And I know that some people see the good in it and some people see the bad in it. he's toughness. He's under guys' skin. He's in their heads. He's competitive. He sets the tone for the whole team. I think that's something that maybe the average viewer might not appreciate, is how much a guy like that can set the level of intensity for the whole team in the locker room and on the court and really get everyone fired up and playing at full speed. And this is, you know, this is a real thing when you play with someone who brings the energy. You know, anyone can feed off of energy. If there's energy in the crowd, if there's energy in the moment, but not everyone can create energy. And so I think what we'll see this year is a lot of those, you know, early start East Coast games or weekend matinee games when, you know, the Clippers play and for the whole first half it feels like everyone's sleepwalking. Patrick Beverley is the kind of guy who can create energy in those kinds of environments and really spark the team. And so that's something I'm looking forward to. And then against the Suns, I thought he was absolutely terrific. 15 points, 2 rebounds, 2 assists, 5 steals, 6 of 8 from the field. Just kind of doing everything right. Really nice finishing going to the basket. And I think what we're seeing is that the Clippers don't have a real point guard this year. Even Teodosic, who is more of a distributor, is not playing that Chris Paul point guard role. And we're seeing almost positionless basketball in the sense that everyone is playing a part. Now, DeAndre Jordan is not dribbling the ball up, and Wesley Johnson is not dribbling the ball up when he's in. And Willie Reed, I suppose, is not dribbling the ball up. So in the Clippers' 9-man rotation, basically you've got 6 guys all splitting point guard duties. Beverly, Teodosic, Rivers, Williams, Griffin, and Gallinari, all taking turns dribbling it up, all finding open guys, all at points creating for themselves or others. And then Wesley Johnson is just there as like a solid guy, plays solid defense, hits open shots. And DeAndre Jordan and Willie Reed are your rim protectors. Now, Teodosic, I thought, had a decent start. I didn't think he had an amazing couple of games, but it's definitely disappointing to see him go down with that injury. And we're, you know, there goes the rookie of the year chances pretty much if he's going to miss a ton of games. But it does present an interesting opportunity for Doc Rivers to take a look at different lineup situations, and for the Clippers rookies, Juwan Evans and Sindarius Thornwell, who are their only depth at the guard positions, to maybe prove themselves. I'm going to talk about Austin and Lou first, and then I'll get into that. So Austin has been bad. Austin's been really bad in these first couple games. I think, you know, I don't think it's a really serious issue with Austin. I mean, he's been in the league. He's been good. It's not like Austin Rivers woke up randomly one day in September and was like, oh, I'm bad at basketball now. No, he's still good at basketball. But what we see with Austin is he had this infection over the summer. He was fatigued all summer. He wasn't working out, and not working out of laziness, but he wasn't working out because of this infection. And so here's a guy who's more or less out of shape, a guy who, according to Chris Webber on the TNT broadcast on Thursday, was sick during the first week of the season. And because he was out of shape coming into camp because of that infection he had over the summer, he hurt himself during the preseason and had to miss most of that time when he could have been getting into shape and rounding into form. So you've got this guy now who is, again, in better shape than most of us because he's an NBA athlete, but he is not in great NBA shape. He is still recovering from that injury. He is sick. And because he hasn't been working out over the summer because of that infection and because he missed most of the preseason injured, he's not in good basketball form. He's rusty, if you will. So all of these things kind of produce the bad performances that we've seen from Austin in the first two games. There's not much you can do about it. Especially with Teodosic injured, you need Austin to be playing because he's still a reliable basketball player, even if he's not being efficient on offense. And I mean, that's it. You need him to play. So all you can do is just have him play himself into shape over the first couple weeks of the season. So yeah, you know, it's a bad start for Austin, and I definitely don't think his struggles are totally over. But I'm also not overly worried about him, even in the medium term. I think in the short term, yeah, he's going to have these struggles. But even in the medium term, I think he'll be fine. Obviously, it's less than ideal for everyone involved, especially Austin, who has a player option next summer, so could potentially opt out and seek a bigger deal. He doesn't want to have this slow start either, so he has all the incentive in the world to, you know, play hard and get himself back into shape and help this team out as much as possible. So it's unfortunate, but I just don't think it's the hugest issue. Lou Williams, I've been really impressed with. And I think there's a lot of conjecture that Lou Williams would be the new Jamal Crawford and everything would be the exact same as it was with Jamal Crawford. And in a way, that's true. Because Lou comes in, he takes a lot of shots, he shoots the ball a lot of times when he's in the game, and he is the spark of the second unit offense. You know, when Blake Griffin is out and Gallinari is the guy who's in, Gallinari isn't as creative as Blake is, even though Gallinari is a very efficient scorer and can score, you know, can create for himself. But Lou Williams comes in, he takes a lot of shots, he's been relatively efficient this year, and he is normally a fairly efficient player, especially for the kind of high-volume bench scorer that he is. But what speaks to me through two games as a difference between him and Jamal Crawford is that Lou Williams is just an honest-to-God, selfish bench scorer. And I think you have to kind of give props to that, because he comes in, he wants to get his points, and he gets his points. He's simple about it. He's effective. There isn't a ton of flash to what he does, even. And he takes some bad shots. He took, like, a step-back corner three in one of the games. You know, not always the best shots. But with Jamal, it felt like it was a lot of showmanship. And this is something that I don't think I especially realized until I was able to kind of comparatively analyze Jamal versus Lou after these first couple games of Lou. But Jamal was always trying to cross someone over. He was, you know, he'd get the ball and then he'd dribble backwards and set up his rhythm and do his dribble moves and then take a pull-up jumper. Lou Williams is just there to score. It's almost like Jamal was there for the mixtape, and you need points for your mixtape, but you also need flashy stuff and, you know, wasted energy. But Lou Williams is just there for the points. All he wants is points. So that's a little more palatable for me, because there's just a little less. I enjoy flash. I enjoy flashiness. But I don't necessarily enjoy pointless flashiness. And it felt like Jamal a lot of times was like wasting time or wasting energy. And it does, so far I haven't seen that with Lou Williams. I've just seen a guy who comes in the game and wants to get points and gets points. And points are good because points help your basketball team win. So as long as he's doing it efficiently, that is fine with me. Now, with Tate Osich out, as I talked about with the forwards, you got three positions, you got 96 minutes. How do you split it up? You could do it with just Beverly, Rivers, and Lou Williams. You can. Now, this would mean essentially that you're like maxing out all of their minutes, so you probably aren't playing any three-guard lineups in that kind of situation, which means that you're probably increasing the likelihood that you turn to a guy like Sam Decker for some small forward minutes. But what I think is actually most likely is that Sindarius Thornwell will get some shots in the rotation in a small role, 8 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes. But he's been the guy that Doc Rivers has turned to first in garbage time off the bench. He's been impressive in those minutes. And he seems like the kind of guy that Doc Rivers likes, who's just a capable defender. I think the ultimate thing, what it will come down to, is if Sindarius can hit shots. Because if he's in the rotation, but he's out there going 0-for-2, 0-for-3 from deep every night, and teams are leaving him open and it's collapsing the Clippers' offense, then they can't play him. And they're going to be in a situation where they have to either, you know, where they have to either try out Juwan Evans or just play with those three guards. But I do think the first guy to sort of get that rotation look, 8 minutes, maybe like 4 minutes to start the second quarter, and then a couple minutes to end the third and start the fourth or something like that. But I think that guy is going to be Sindarius Thornwell. So that's what I'm looking for on that. He's impressed me with his finishing so far. You know, we all know the kind of defender that he is. The main question mark just remains that shot, because so long as he is not a super quick, effective dribbler and an amazing passer, he's not going to be a combo guard. And if you're not a combo guard that can create, you have to be able to be a 3-and-D wing. Now, because of his size, he's really more of a shooting guard, but he does have that length and he's strong, so he could play a little bit of small forward in certain matchups. But 3-and-D means 3-and-D. You got to be able to hit those open threes at least a respectable rate. If he can hit 35% from the NBA, you know, from the NBA three, then great. But the Clippers, without Chris Paul especially, can't afford to have a Luke and Mbamute kind of guy on offense who can only operate out of the corners and passes up a lot of open shots because he's not a good shooter. They need capable offensive players all over the floor. If he can prove himself to be capable, I think he's that guy. If he comes in and he's missing shots and defenses aren't respecting him, I think you probably have to go with someone else. That's going to do it for today's episode of Locked On Clippers Podcast. We went a little bit over time, but we didn't have those episodes last week, so I wanted to make sure I got through everything. We will be back. With any luck, the recording software will continue working, and we will be back tomorrow talking about the Clippers game tomorrow night against the Utah Jazz and talking about what the Agua Caliente Clippers did over the weekend. And that's it. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback, hit me up on Twitter at LucasJHan. Email me lhan.clipsnation@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, guys. This is Lucas Han signing off for Locked On Clippers.
Is democracy in danger or decline? Condoleezza Rice, William Galston, and Carlos Gutierrez and others take on this question in the fall edition of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. Surveys show Americans place less trust in institutions like the media and business. Others contend America has faced far more challenging periods and emerged strong. Leading policymakers, Bush Institute experts, and respected journalists take on this debate. Read about it at bushcenter.org/catalyst. Catalyst.